You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
Welcome to this place made holy by our presence. It's rooted in love, inspired by wisdom, nourished by hope, grounded in our seven principles, fed by our traditions, grown by our deeds. Those words are from Jinna Hastings and they're in the little book produced by New Zealand and Australian Unitarians.
Positive thinking, personal growth, and the relentless pursuit of happiness are pretty much moral imperatives. And there's no shortage of experts producing blogs and podcasts and books that promise to help you on your journey, but a counterculture is emerging. Sven Brinkmann, a Danish psychology professor and leader of the anti-self-help movement, says it's time to reject the self-improvement ideology, refuse the cult of positive thinking, and stand firm. Brinkmann argues we should resist the injunctions to constantly be happier, healthier, and better. We only allow to be positive. We are only allowed to be happy. And anything that threatens these states of mind is considered wrong. All that is painful, all that feels overwhelming and unbearable, whether domestically, socially, or even politically and culturally, must therefore be repressed, he argues. In a culture of mandated positivity, if we are unhappy, we only have ourselves to blame. People's problems are explained with reference to the fact that they weren't positive enough, Professor Brinkmann said. It is the individual who is to blame for what happens, even when the cause of the problem is social or structural or organizational. But there's a paradox. While positive psychology has become more broadly accepted, rates of depression continue to rise. The self-help books promise to orient the individual towards something that is meaningful. But the problem is that what is meaningful, according to the self-help industry, is always what is within the individual. So the person must look within themselves, listen to their inner voice, find meaning within. This whole inward turn, Professor Brinkmann argues, is only making us more unhappy. Self-development, however, was not always such a profoundly oppressive pursuit. In the 1960s, self-actualization was about liberation. It emerged as a reaction to rigid social structures, severed from its revolutionary origins. Professor Brinkmann argues self-development has been co-opted by a happiness industry that tells us our ordinary misery is unacceptable and provides us fulfillment through self-growth. It is exactly what science wants you to do. It is exactly what consumer society wants you to do, to be constantly on the move, constantly adaptable, flexible, and changing all the time. To put it simply, so they can sell you new products. You should never be content, you should never be satisfied, you should always look for more. This is the new guise of the self-realization ideology, and it is no longer helping us. Perhaps we even need to go back to some of the virtues that were lost in the much-needed counterculture that emerged in the 1960s. To counter a self-help industry that makes constant demands on consumers, through affirmations such as, I choose to be present in all I do, I am the architect of my life. I build its foundations and choose its contents. I choose my choice. Professor Brinkman offers a handy 7-step manual. A dose of negativity. Professor Brinkman's anti-self-help guide promises liberation through a dose of refreshing negativity based on Roman Stoic thought. He argues for a return to civic virtues, duties, and ethical obligations. Roman Stoics were the self-help authors of their day. It's more important to be a decent human being than to be about yourself all the time. It's more important to fulfill your obligations, he said. We need a language with which to talk about those aspects of life, and I don't think the whole self-improvement, self-optimization, self-development language is adequate for that. Here are his 7 tips for moving forward. 1. Cut out the navel gazing. 2. Focus on the negative in your life. 3. Learn to say no. 4. This is a bit of an interesting one. Suppress your feelings. 5. Sack your coach. 6. Read a novel, not a self-help book or inspiring biography. And 7. Dwell on the past. Interesting.
Well, that worked well, didn't it? I'm a bit of a Tim Minchin fan, and I particularly enjoyed his address to the University of West Australia, in which he presented 9 lessons to echo the 9 carols and readings of Christmas. It came to my mind because it's this time of year, and it's New Year and its attendant resolutions to do better. That's how the theme came about, like resolutions to exercise more and eat less. Well, the surfeit of Christmas foods leads most of us to an austerity attack in the short term. Holidays make fitting a swim into your day a little easier, but it won't be long before real life takes over and old patterns reassert themselves. Of course, you may have made resolutions that are more profound, like being more compassionate, meditating every day, volunteering and engaging in good works. In which case, you will probably regret your almost inevitable relapse even more. But inspired by Tim, I started to question this compulsion to be better and wondered if it were actually dysfunctional. Tim's first lesson was you don't have to have a dream. Americans on talent shows always talk about their dreams, which, of course, could take you most of your life to achieve. And by the time you achieve your dream and are staring into the abyss of meaninglessness of your achievement, you'll be almost dead. So it won't matter. Instead, he recommended passionate dedication to short-term goals. Be micro-ambitious. Put your head down and work with pride on whatever is in front of you. If you focus too far ahead, you'll miss the shiny thing right in the corner of your eye. His second lesson was, don't seek happiness. Happiness is, after all, like an orgasm. If you think too much about it, it will disappear. Keep busy. Make someone else happy. You might get some as a side effect. We didn't evolve to be constantly happy. Contented Homo erectus got eaten before passing on their genes. And remember, it's all luck. He was talking to uni graduates. You're lucky to be here, he said. You're lucky to be brought up by a nice family who encouraged you to go to uni. Or if you were born into a horrible family, you're still lucky because you had the right DNA. So when you were born into that horrible family, your brain allowed you to make the right sort of decisions to end up with a university degree. Well, that's enough of Tim. You just Google his 9 lessons if you want to hear the other 6. But I'm sure you get my drift. You cannot take all credit for your successes, nor truly blame others for their failures. We are each dealt a different hand in this life. Now, getting back to being the very best that we can be, If you recall the Life Matters article that David read you, it referred to the profoundly depressing effect navel gazing has and suggested it was more important to be a decent human being than to be yourself all the time. And because 3 is such a magical number, I'm going to provide a third reference to the inefficacy of self-help. The author, Mark Manson, is a 34-year-old Texan, described in interviews as being crude and vulgar, but also a treasurer. His book, with its very indelicate title, was the bestseller this year, ironically, in the self-help sector, and second best in non-fiction books, in sales terms. Mark embraced self-help books in his 20s, but later came to the opinion that they were helpful only in limited contexts. I adopted a lot of goals and values that were very typical of the normal self-help stuff. I wanted to start my own business, I wanted to create freedom for myself, travel the world and have unique experiences, he said. I went on and achieved a lot of those things, but once I achieved them, it felt kind of meaningless. Nobody actually cares if I climb the Great Wall of China this week, so why am I getting so worked up about this stuff? I realised achieving all these things was not going to make everything great. And that had a big impact on me because those were the scripts I'd bought into. In the end, he decided it was his core relationships, committing himself to people and places that mattered. So, let's backtrack. The most recent self-help movement began with liberation from rigid societal strictures in the 1960s, but it has gone off, hasn't it? It's not liberation. Now, why? I think it's because it's become too profitable. The happiness industry is a $10 billion a year industry in America alone. It's mostly the privilege of it's mostly the province of privileged white people. They're cashed up and they can afford to go on retreats or do workshops and pay for their CDs and DVDs and books. The happiness industry does not go out of its way to reach the poor or the unemployed. Now, it's good and true that your personal success is dependent on how well you play the cards that life deals you. It's also good and true that you play those cards more effectively when you stay positive and motivated. Fail at this and you greatly reduce your likelihood of success. However, self-help becomes toxic when it's used to blame other people for not being successful when circumstances have dealt them a weak hand, when luck runs against them, and even when they've not played their cards very well. Phrases like, they should pull themselves up by their own bootstraps, are cringeworthy. People born into poor families in awful neighbourhoods are playing their awful cards well if they manage to survive. It's unrealistic to expect financial success. There are, of course, people who've climbed up from harrowing backgrounds, but those are an exception. Equally cringeworthy is when successful entrepreneurs claim that they're a self-made man or a self-made woman, while ignoring the public infrastructure that made their business possible, and of course ignoring the employees who do the work. Another thing that bothers me about self-help is that it's too often used to fleece people who don't know any better. Programs, often mandatory, that train poor people for jobs that don't exist are a prime example of this. So while the motivation and positivity of the self-help movement are essential to personal success, self-help is completely toxic when it's positioned as panacea for public policy. The notion it's your own fault if you become sick or are born poor is toxic. It rears its ugly head in parliamentary debates here. Remember the lifters and leaners rhetoric. I'd like to share a very clear example from Congress in the States. A Republican from Alabama is referring to a so-called health care reform, My understanding is that it will allow insurance companies to require people who have higher health costs to contribute more to the insurance pool that helps offset all these costs, thereby reducing the cost to those people who lead good lives. They're healthy. They've done the things to keep their body healthy. Well, that's from Mo Brooks, whose mum taught economics and whose dad was an electrical engineer. Or to use an American metaphor, it's from someone on third base who thought he was hitting a home run. It's stating that illness is the result of not living a good life, and it's using self-help to bludgeon rather than to inspire people. By all means, let's encourage people to do the best with what they've got, but let's not blame them if they experience bad luck or are finding it difficult to overcome a background of poverty. Now, for the last and final time, getting back to the best that we can be, why is it so hard to change our behaviour? Well, it's a bit of a no-brainer, really. It's habitual. A habit is a learned behaviour that's repeated so often that it becomes involuntary. When it's a repeated behaviour that complies with the ideals of health, righteousness, and wisdom, it can go by other names, such as spiritual practice, ritual, and routine. And when it's a repeated behaviour contrary to the notions of health, righteousness, and wisdom, its synonyms are obsession and addiction. Sovereign will, consciousness, and necessity were once keywords of this literature. Nowadays, they're mindfulness, happiness, and autopilot. Thou shalt's have faded. The call for action comes not from on high. It comes from one's longing for happiness. Stephen Covey's 1997 Habits of Highly Effective People is probably the best of the contemporary American habits literature. He spawned a mass market for all things seven: the 7 Habits of Highly Effective Teens, the 7 Habits of Happy Kids, the 7 Habits of Network Marketing Professionals. But if we're looking for the origin of this voracious appetite for self-improvement, we have to go back 2 centuries before Covey to Benjamin Franklin. For Franklin, cultivating wholesome habits was as crucial as discarding bad ones. Franklin warned that those very behaviours that cunningly take advantage of our intention would keep us from ethical improvement. In his youth, Franklin opined that church services seemed to hold no promise for his moral perfection. So he took matters into his own hands and drew up a list of 12 virtues to become second nature. A Quaker friend gently reminded him that he'd left a very important one out that he could use more of. It was humility. Franklin conceded and added it to his list. He then figured out the habits that would ingrain these virtues. For example, tranquility. Be not disturbed at trifles or at accidents, common or unavoidable. And for the elusive humility, he pulled out the big guns. Imitate Jesus and Socrates. Now, Franklin's 13 virtues method continues to be put into use to this day, but of course there are new technologies like smartphones for graphing, charting, and deploying mantras. The post-it method involves sticking a yellow note on the pantry door to help the reader's higher self stop his lower self from mindless munching. Are you truly hungry or just bored? Not unlike today's habit industry, Franklin also had his social blind spots. In addition to his knack for industriousness and regimentation, he had his common law wife, Deborah, to take care of the 2 children and his illegitimate son. He had a devoted sister, Jane, who, though herself was an impoverished mother of 12, served as her elder brother's scribe, family record keeper, and personal soap maker. In addition, he had household slaves who tended to his earthly needs so that he could devote his time to cultivating virtues. He had, in short, a virtual staff of loved ones and subordinates to help him cultivate his self-reliance. Today's habit industry is similarly blinkered about the social and economic architecture which, for many, makes cultivating personally rewarding habits possible. So my message, don't fall over in admiration when self-made people blow their own trumpets. Don't be too harsh on yourself when you fall off the wagon, metaphorically. By all means, spend a little time reflecting on the habits or the mindset that caused the fall, but don't self-flagellate. If you must be better, be realistic. Short-term goals are better than long. Making the lives of others better, making the world better, is probably going to be more efficacious than focusing on self-improvement. And above all, be kind to yourself. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. God help us. God help us to live slowly, to move simply, to look softly, to allow emptiness to let the heart create for us.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianessay@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching Essay Unitarians.